and good Friday morning. Friday, January the 4th, 2018, 17 minutes past the hour. You're tuned to Over the Back Fence with Pastor Steve Whitaker and myself, Scott Spears. Pastor, how are you? We are into 2019.
I'm doing great, but you know, I'm trying to dodge all this sickness out there. It seems everywhere I go, somebody's sick.
Boy, it really has crept up.
Yes, it has. I've seen, kids out of school and a lot of things going on, but at least most of the sickness doesn't seem to be lasting too long.
That's a good thing.
Absolutely. So how you been?
Been good. It's been a good year so far.
Good. Frank's with us today. How are you, Frank?
Oh, I'm just fine. Thank you. I woke up this morning.
Hey, you know, that's always a positive, isn't it?
It is. It is.
What kind of idea, Scott, do you have this year rolling into the new year? We got a lot of changes going on in things that we can do and things that we don't have much control over either. So,
well, you know, there's always a lot of things at the beginning of the year that are fun to think about. It's funny because when you poll people, just yourself, if you go out and ask people, what do you want to change at the beginning of the year? It's always weight. It's always exercise. It's always to stop something. And I always wonder why more people don't start something.
Ah, good point.
Yeah. Like exercising, if you want to do that, or giving, or if something wasn't going well for you in the last year, maybe you want to start on the way to changing that.
Doing something different.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, many times, though, starting something involves stopping something. Like, I'll give you a good example. I had encouraged people on our Christmas Eve service that, you know, this next year, I said, try picking up your Bible every day and just starting to read it and get familiar with it. Well, that's great. That's a start. But that also means a stop. And that stop means you got to hit the TV button or you've got to do whatever, you know, and you've got to take that time and do it. So there's usually, a lot of times, there's a stop and a start.
Well, I think a lot of people I think I said this last week, and I do believe it's true. When I was in high school, I worked in a restaurant. And it always seemed to me like the people who had some kind of spirituality in their life, went to church, did things of that nature, were happier per capita than the people who didn't. Their lives were always a little more hard to navigate. They always seemed a little more upset. And I think that's because there was no structure, no spiritual structure. At some point, you got to have something.
Yeah, I think so. I agree. And you know, I heard a thing the other day, a poll that was, they were polling married people. And they said of married people, the ones that did have that that faith, that walk, that spiritual structure, they claimed their marriages were better. You're not obviously not across the board, but the poll was very well, you know, overwhelming people that were in that situation. I think that a lot of it is, to be honest, if you look at the Bible, it talks about marriage and it talks about faith and walking together and how we treat each other and putting others first and all those things that we do. And, you know, when we're avoid from that, where are we going to get that structure? It's real interesting. I think that, you know, the Bible isn't something that public society, as far as laws go, have wanted it to be out there a lot, or be, you know, they don't want it in the schools, they don't want it in, it's not that you can't carry it to school because you can. It's not because kids can't read it in school because they can, so don't think that they can't. But it's very interesting that our basic moral values in this country come directly out of that book, if you think about it. And if you take away that, where's your value? I mean, what do you come down to as your authority on why you don't steal, why don't you lie, why don't you do all these things? And it's because people would naturally rationalize a way to do whatever made them feel good otherwise.
Well, you know, it's interesting. There's a story this morning out of Columbus, and it's I think it's in Pickerington, that the police chief has been accused of making racial slurs. Mm-hmm. But it's from an anonymous source. Now, I always wonder, when an anonymous source comes out and makes an accusation like that and provides no real proof, which after reading this story, I really can't see what the proof is, why do we investigate that stuff? I think you got to have a name and a face.
I agree. And, you know, there's such a mob mentality. And the sad thing is, he's probably going to get railroaded out of office, whether he did anything or not. And, you know, this whole thing about racial slurs, are they wrong? Yes. Should we do them? No. Should we be kind? Yes. But it goes that way with everything else that we're getting a little too touchy on. The fact is that most people have made a comment in their life derogatory about somebody. I'm not just talking about a racial slur. I'm talking about a particular group of people or a type of people or so many things that we can be offended by. And I find it interesting that, you know, if you go out in culture, the very people that are complaining about being slurred at or the slurs on are using the same slurs. And so I think that what we just need to do is start paying a little bit more attention to what we do say and not being that way. But this we've really got a mob mentality when it comes to political correctness. But I agree with you, Scott. If you're not willing to stand behind your words, keep your trap shut.
Well, also, it's not even that for me. What is your proof?
Right.
You know, even if you are coming to the table as a face and a name, where's your proof? I wish more people, when somebody made an accusation about somebody, the first retort would be, what proof do you have?
Where is your proof?
Yeah. Well,
it always seems to be put on the person that's being accused to prove their innocence, and that's not
right.
Where we're supposed to be innocent until proven guilty in this country. And we seem today to have changed over to guilty before proven innocent.
Well, it's funny because the big crimes in our society, murder, rape, things of that nature, usually the people don't have a problem coming forward and saying, this is why I know it happened, I'm willing to testify, and here's the proof. But when it comes to things like racial slurs that could basically, you're not going to go to jail for that, but you might lose your job, or financial crimes, a lot of times people don't want to put their name to that stuff because really they don't have any proof. I wish that what we had in this country were laws. If you make an accusation about somebody and it's proven not to be true, then I think you should be charged with something because you need to think before you make that.
Very interesting. It takes me back to the Bible once again. Do you remember in the Bible what happened if a man came forward and did not want to marry his wife based on the fact that she was impure and then proven to be that she was pure, and it was a lie and an accusation? See, the Bible had laws set up in it that if you make an accusation, it better be true. And I think one of the reasons that people will come forward anonymously with things they don't have proof for and they want to hide back in the corner is because many of these things they've probably done themselves, and they don't want the tables turned on them.
Well, I am very careful never to make an accusation about somebody unless I have proof, because you do put people through the ringer, and there are no repercussions in our society for that. Whoever made this accusation about this police chief, you know, his life is in the front page today. His life will be messed around with. There'll be an investigation into him, but the person who made it, nothing. And, you know, even if he did it, and as you aptly put, racial slurs are not right. You shouldn't make them. Don't do it. But what is this person's motive for turning you in? Is it a bone you're picking with them? Is it a grudge? I don't think that is a good reason to go after somebody.
You know, and I wonder why they went out. You know, someone went after Paula Deen in the height of her.
Oh, I remember that.
Of her cook show and really huge popularity. And I kind of wonder about that. You know, first of all, they really took something that was very old, that wasn't something, and they destroyed her. I mean, they destroyed her livelihood. They destroyed her company, her name. And Come on, folks. I mean, the lady said she was sorry and it was years ago. Let it go.
Well, sorry,
aren't we a country
doesn't
of forgiveness?
Work. Not anymore. Mm-hmm. No. Sorry doesn't work. That what everybody gives a public apology now, but it doesn't matter. It's too late, and I don't know why that is. That's really a bothersome part of our society. We have very little forgiveness. One of the things I'm learning lately is we are handing out felonies a lot now. And it's hard for those people to get jobs.
Oh, my.
Housing. It doesn't matter how long ago it was. That's very depressing.
I think that what bothers me a lot about our felony rate in that part of law, and always has, is that if you have money and you have access to a good attorney, many times, not always, but many times, you can avoid that. If you're a person of no means, good luck.
Well, my question is, okay, let's say you, because you can get felonies for minor theft, you can get felonies for drug issues. Now, you serve your time, do your thing. You're not going to go to prison for life for those things. When you get out, what are you supposed to do? You can't get a place to live. You can't get a job. What are you going to do?
You know, I think that, you know, maybe we need to create within the system a felony board. And what they do is they review cases and review where people have come and then expunge the felony when they get to a certain point that they've reached that.
Well, isn't prison supposed to be...
rehabilitation.
Well, didn't they call them reformatories?
They did.
Reformatories. And isn't it, at the end of your service, isn't the idea that you've paid your debt to society? Well, if you've got a felony, you keep on paying.
This is true. This is true. And I'm not sure about I don't know. There's arguments on both sides of that, but I would say that I've thought for a long time a lot of these things need reviewed. But you know, at the same time, I don't know what we're going to do about the current drug situation when it comes to felonies in jail. We have a real problem. Frank and I were discussing that on the way in this morning, that, you know, our culture's gotten to a point that we can do away with one drug and immediately something pops right back on the scene. It's not the drug itself all the time, even though heroin's so addictive, as it is people's desire to be in an altered state. They're not happy. They don't seem to have hope. And there always seems to be reaching out. People have to find hope before they get on drugs.
Well, the thing that bothers me, and I've seen this a lot in the last year, and without pointing out exact examples, but people can find them. When it comes to the drug issue, the number one addiction right now in Ohio is opioids. Mm-hmm. And opioids have to be prescribed. Now, nobody ever puts the doctor in jail. Nobody ever even charges the doctor with anything. And then when we look at theft, like minor cases of theft, now nobody ever goes to the person who was overseeing that person. Now, where were you? You were supposed to be the check and balance, so that person didn't do that. There's no punishment for that person.
Well, I think when it comes to theft and things that are non-addictive, I think that there's some personal responsibility in knowing what's right and wrong, whether someone's overseeing you or not.
Well, I guess there was a particular case, without going into it, that happened in the area. And it was a person who worked for the public. Now, tax returns had to be filed. Expenditures would have had to have been approved by somebody. Why did nobody notice any? This went on for years. And nobody ever noticed anything?
Well, somebody didn't do their job.
Right.
But that'd mean they did a crime.
No, I don't think they did a crime, but I think that they let it go on long enough. If they would have caught it early, it probably would have just been firing that person. It wouldn't have been criminal charges, but it happened for so long.
But that person kept doing it over.
Oh, they're
over.
Not right.
Yeah.
I mean, they're not right for doing it. And I don't think the person is right for abusing the opioids. But I do think that it does start somewhere.
Well, part of the problem is we don't have... Oh, I don't want to get into it. We'll be two shows on this. But, you know, really, I'm telling you, working from the standpoint of someone that is... I am an EMT also, a volunteer EMT. And when I think about the Narcan, the Naxalone, I think part of the problem with the opioids is that young people see so many people that have been on it for a long time and aren't dead yet. And what I mean by that is I'm not saying they should die. I don't mean that. But I'm saying is with the current way to bring people back and the way in which it does it so rapidly that if they have access, many people, I'll give you an example. I was doing some clinicals one time in a hospital, and they had a lady that was came in, had just overdosed on opioids, and she was released. And that night, at 9 o'clock, they got another call. She overdosed again on the same thing. And young people see this and they think, I think if our young people could see today just how literally horrific the result always is. You know, in the last week, two people, people that I know extendedly, not personally, have died from overdoses. One's a 40-year-old man that had been playing with that roulette game for some time. And it'll finally get you. And another one was a young woman, beautiful young lady, talented young lady, just a few years out of school. And you know, this is a horrific thing. And I think we talk about felonies and whatnot. I don't know about the user so much, but the user always eventually becomes a dealer to some extent. Do you realize that? They have to, because they can't get their drugs cheap enough if they don't bring other people into the picture. And that's the way it's set up to work. So before that person gets to that point and they get arrested, I think that they really need to, there needs to be some more teeth behind rehab, for one. It needs to be longer term, and it needs to be something more life-changing. Most people will admit that work with people that are addicts, that they have to change their environment. If they come out of jail, they come out of rehab and go right back to the same family and friends that are using, it's only a matter of time till they're using again. So they've got to do that. But I think that the people that are caught selling, I don't know what the answer is, but there has to be some unbelievably harsh penalty to where they don't want to have the opportunity to do it again. Because that's where your problem lies. And I don't know the answer. We have a real societal problem right now.
Well, see, that to me is kind of the circle. I don't believe that the doctor believes that he's going to, or she is going to get somebody addicted to a painkiller. I don't believe that's what they set out to do, but I believe it happens. And even with a drug dealer, and that's it's a crazy term and a crazy way to say this, but usually the drug dealers aren't the ones overdosing. And
no, they're not.
So, you know, I don't even know in their own mind if they say, boy, I'm really out to kill these people.
They just don't care.
They just don't care. So,
again, might as well be out to kill them. What's the difference?
Well, I think that, I think sometimes in that case, you know what I never understand with drug dealers in general? When drug dealers are arrested, they say, well, we can't charge them heavy. Well, can't you charge them with tax fraud? I'm sure they're not declaring that income. Can't you do that?
Well, being the fact everything is done in cash, it'd be kind of hard to have a paper trail to even charge them.
But they find them with all this money.
Well, okay. Well, they could say, I've been saving that since I was 8 years old. You know, I mean, honestly, like we said, you said, you know, where's the proof? And when it comes to that, that side of it has to prove it, too. You know, it's just, the whole thing is very, very tough. I will go back to the doctors on this, though. And I've seen way too much of this. they got to back off on prescribing opioids. And what I mean by that is, I had someone very close to me one time have a vasectomy. His doctor sent him home with 3 Vicodin, a prescription for 30 with 1 refill. Now, you tell me that doctor needed to do that. The person in question that I'm talking about said they took the one on the way home. They took one that later that day because they were feeling kind of sore. And the last one went in the trash along with the prescriptions. But what if you're a person that thought, oh, the doctor prescribed these, I must really need them. You know, there's where we run into the problem. So many times, so many times, I see these people that are ostracized from the community and from their families because they become drug addicts. And if you trace it back, it was over an accident. I've had 2 friends of mine from school, good families. One of them, their son, killed himself because he had been in a car accident, was severely hurt, and then couldn't get off drugs. And the other one, very similar case, ended up shooting himself because he couldn't deal with what he was doing to his family anymore, and i.e. stealing and whatnot, and he couldn't deal with the addiction anymore. And in both those cases, it was from over-prescribing of opioids. And I will say this. I went through a really bad time of shingles a year ago. And if you've ever had shingles, you don't want them. It's one of the most painful things that we ever endure. Some women that have had them have even said that it's worse than any labor they ever went through, and it doesn't go away. But here's the thing. I don't like what opioids do. So therefore, I said, I'm not taking them. I put them away, and I just went to Aleve. I have to tell you, the pain was no different. All the opioid is doing is tricking your brain a little bit and playing with your head. But as far as alleviating pain, the only thing alleviating pain is the pain reliever inside what you're taking. It's the opioid that makes you feel a little la-la-la. But the problem with opioids are, especially for pain, when you try to back off of them, it's painful. You know, if any addict will tell you that the hardest part about detoxing is the physical pain of the whole thing from opioids. Mm-hmm. So here you are, you're taking something to alleviate pain, and the minute you go to back off of it, if you've been taking it any time at all, the pain's really strong, so you keep taking it. And before you know it, you have the mental addiction long after the original pain is gone. And this is why I don't like opioids at all. I firmly believe that unless it's a case of unbelievable pain, such as a cancer, as something that is causing extreme pain from an accident, I know there's people that literally, there's a difference between having a total degenerative spine that is killing you and somebody that says, my back hurts, and the doctor gives them opioids. And there's a whole lot of that going on. And there's the ones that turn into the addicts. And the point is, unless it's something that is chronic, something you're always going to have that's extremely painful, take some Aleve, folks. I'm serious. And the doctors need to hear that. Quit prescribing this stuff.
You know, it's a funny thing. I think this all comes back to an addictive personality because...
Sure it does.
If you go in the hospital, and let's say you have an illness, and you go in and say it's bad enough to where they're going to admit you. Now, usually the hospital will treat the illness, the fluids or whatever they have to do to get that illness better. A lady was having childbirth. They take the epidural. Now, that's for pain. Mm-hmm. But people aren't lining up saying, give me epidurals. So I think what is going on is I think if you, what I have noticed, because I went to a rehab center once for a family member. He was in there, and I went because they have visitor's day. And the people who were addicted to those drugs also had the addictions to alcohol. They had the addictions to smoking. They had the addictions to eating. Everything they did in excess.
This is true. But I will say this also, that the difference between those addictions, which are out there, and yes, there's a lot of addictive personalities. I've been raised around them my whole life in different family and whatnot. Matter of fact, I'll be honest, I'll be straight honest with you guys, I have an addictive personality. I recognize that. I have a personality that if I got started on something, it's hard to not do it. When I was a younger person, I smoked. And it was really odd because, you know, that stuff leaves your body in a couple days when you quit smoking. What's left is the mental side of it. So that's that addictive personality. But you make a decision to stop and you stop. The problem with opioids is it will create an addiction drive that you never had before, even if you don't have an addictive personality. It creates a drive.
And I think the reason it creates that, you know, alcohol is interesting because I always look at somebody who is an alcoholic and I think, what happened that caused that? And usually what you will find, because there are bars all over town where people can go in and have one or two beers and then go home and never have a problem with it, never have beer in the household. When I was growing up, there was never beer in my refrigerator. Now, my parents drank if they went out New Year's Eve or special occasions like that, but there was never beer at home. They never drank at home. They were not, that wasn't their beverage with dinner. And I think the difference is I think people get depressed, people have no hope, and it takes them away from that. And I think the opioids do the same thing. So I think it's a combination of an addictive personality already sitting there and also you falling on hard times, because you won't find too many gregarious people. And I use that term specifically because it's not about rich and poor, because poor people can be rich people can be depressed too.
At an equal rate, yeah. I believe that.
Yeah, and I think it's just you feel hopeless. I think that's why this happens to so many celebrities, because I think they're filling a void and they think they filled it,
but it didn't fill it. I don't think that depression doesn't know economics, and I think that it is something that is within us that we need to learn to deal with. I think it's obviously it's something that as a pastor I say I go to the Lord for my strength, and I know that he's there, and I know people that don't understand that, and that's why I encourage them to get into the Word and to read it and understand it and to grow with it, so they will. But this whole thing about the opioids, one of the big problems beyond just filling a void is that when people do a really strong opioid for the first or second time, a heroin, an Oxycontin, maybe not even a Vicodin, but it gives them a euphoria that's beyond their normal feeling. Even if they feel normal and they're not a depressed person, they get this unbelievable euphoria. I've had more addicts tell me, the first time I did it, I just can't imagine ever feeling that well again. Because it takes all those pleasure receptors in our brain and just dumps them. And it's like you just went to heaven. And they think, wow, I got to do this again. And every addict I've ever talked to will also tell me the second thing. And that is, I never got that high again. The second one was never like the first. Mm-hmm. But you're always trying to get back to it. And eventually what happens is you get yourself in a point where your pleasure sensors are worn out, they're gone. And you're not going to get it back unless you get high. And the only way that you can begin to rebuild that and get it back is long-term separation from the drug itself and let your mind and your body be rebuilt. And not everyone's willing to do that. I've talked to a prison guard that was telling me that it's in a women's facility. These women come in and they're a mess. You know, they're addicted, they've done something criminal now, and now they're going to prison, and they're just a mess. And he said, you know, after about 2 or 3 months, the person comes back. And they realize what they've done, and they're repentive, and they want their kids, and they want their family. And all these things take place. And then, unfortunately, when they get back out, the same people are literally waiting on them. I know that they'll ring their phone off the wall to get to them. And it's a sad, sad situation. But I'll be honest with you, unless people decide that I'm really going to change, I've argued this about people that want to just go into the little programs where you're out, but you go in for an hour and you get a rubber stamp because you were there for an hour. And that works for about 1% of the people, literally, if that. From my experience with seeing it, what does work is somebody that says, I'm getting my life together and I need to get into at least a year-long program somewhere else where they can teach me and I can retrain my mind to be positive, to want to work and make something of myself. And those long-term facilities have a success rate that's unbelievable. But very few people are willing to do that, because they still want access to the things they want access to. Maybe it's not a drug. Maybe they don't want to be away from family. Look, you're going to lose your family anyway. So why not go somewhere for a year where they understand what you're doing and then come back and try to reclaim them, and you may have a wonderful family again. But if you don't step out and do that long-term thing, you're going to lose them anyway. I've seen it too many times. It's a sad, sad thing. But it's what's going to happen with the whole thing. And I think that we need to make tougher penalties on those bringing them into the country. I'm sorry, I don't know, a lot of people don't believe in capital punishment. You're bringing drugs into this country, that's a death sentence. I'm sorry. If it were, people say, well, why would you want to kill all those people? No, less people would die. That's what you got to understand. Because the people bringing it in know, I get caught, I'm gone. I'm not doing it. Okay? And you have less people bringing it in. And, you know, step up that kind of stuff. I know it sounds harsh, but the truth is that sometimes harsh is crucial. What I don't understand, Scott, is the fact that 5 years ago, I looked up the government statistics on this, and I've never done it since. But 5 years ago, we had over 50 metric tons of heroin cross our southern border. 50 metric tons was their estimate. Do you guys know how much heroin that is? That's insane. And that was in 1 year. Now, if our government, if our officials are elected, and one of the things they raise their hand and swear to is to protect the people of the United States, and we've got 50 metric tons coming in, and it is reaching our young people, it's killing our kids, it's killing our society, then it needs to go back on them why they're allowing this to continue. This whole political battle over the border is a joke. The reasoning behind it's a joke. You know, many of the very people that were for it are now against it. Well, they're against it because who wants it? I mean, that's so obvious to the American people, it isn't funny. I mean, they hate Trump. They don't want him to succeed. So this is one big failure we're going to give him, and he's going to lose his whole base. I mean, that's what it's buying. And in the meantime, who's paying for it? Our kids. Our kids are paying for this. You know, the stuff is coming over like just, it's unbelievable the amount that's coming over the border. And you know, I'm sorry, but do the same thing on the northern border. I mean, whatever borders we have to protect in this country, we need to let aliens into this country. We need to let them in. We need to let aliens in that want to better their lives, have a good reason, but there has to be checks and balances. And that's something protecting that border does. It says, okay, you want to come in. What are your credentials? What are you going to, you know, why? And there needs to be a process. But to just leave people to cross a river and flood into the country, or arrest them and release them and they never see them again. I've got to call you politicians out there right now, and I'm talking about all of you, Republicans and Democrats both. You're killing our children, and you don't seem to care. And that's what needs to be resonated today by people. It's all, politics seems to be more important than the American life when it comes to our economics, when it comes to opportunity, when it comes to everything that affects our children in this country. it is more important to keep a position, it's more important to get reelected, it's more important to get your way or take care of the lobbyists or those on your side than it is to protect the people that they have been called to serve. And one thing we have to remember that we've forgotten a long time ago in our country, too often we call these people our political leaders. They're not our political leaders. They are our political representatives. We are the leaders. They're representing us, not the other way around. And if people, Republicans and Democrats, would come together as a block and say, enough, enough of this selfish stuff. We're going to do what's right for our country. Because I honestly believe, Scott, that you and I could sit across from each other, put issues on the table, and we could work through any particular issue out there and come up with a common solution better than those clowns in Washington can do it.
Well, that's the problem. Two things I've noticed recently that are bothersome to me, and it didn't used to be this way, and I don't know why it is now. I can honestly tell you there is no politician, local, state, national, who I, this will seem strange to say this, that I revere. Now, lately, I have seen a lot of reverement. I mean, if this is your guy or your woman, that's your guy or your woman, and they can do no wrong. I don't know anybody like that. There's, in my world, there's nobody like that. Number two is I don't understand why these problems that we have, we attack every problem in the United States rationally in a way on the supply side. We don't attack it on the demand side, it's the supply side. So if there is no demand for this, highly unlikely it will continue on. And that's why I've never understood why we don't attack the drug problem on the supply side. I don't understand why we don't attack the immigration problem on the supply side. We attack it on the demand side. We arrest the people who are doing drugs. We arrest the people who are coming over the border illegally. But we never attack the people who are hiring them illegally, who are Americans. We never even fine them.
You know, it's interesting, Scott, if I could interject just a minute. Let's talk about not the supply side, but the
demand
side. Thank you. I'm sorry. One of the huge problems we have today is that companies can't fill positions. I'm just telling you. I mean, I can give you a list of them right now. And their biggest problem is employment. And while it is, you all right, Frank?
Yeah.
While it is true that there's work out there, but they're telling me that they can't fill the positions because they can't get people to want to do the positions and work the jobs. And I think that two of the problems we've run into today that are crucial is that parents have not had their kids grow up. Simple as that. I mean, I look out there. Yeah, there are certain situations that are different than others. I'm not tarring everyone the same brush. But I'm saying that when Johnny can stay at home till he's 40 years old and never get a job because he's your baby, we got way too much of that going on. And we have these Latin American people that know the only way they're going to eat is to work, and they come over here and they're willing to work. I was in a construction business 30 years ago and had been for years. And I remember it was about 30 years ago when we first started getting all the Mexican construction workers come in. I had never seen any before. And I saw these hardcore young guys that were Americans, that were black and white out there mixing mortar and putting bricks on a house and knowing they had to learn a trade and doing all these things. Within a span of 5 years, they were replaced by Mexicans. And I'm telling you something, it wasn't because of the wage, because we didn't get paid stink anyway back then. But it was because they were willing to work, and they would show up no matter what, and it didn't matter if they had a hangover, they were there working. And this is where there's that demand part. And, you know, when you talk about the drugs, what are some other things we've done? We haven't, we've become such an affluent country that our kids have not grown up knowing they need to work if they wanted a bicycle. The second thing that we've done is we took prayer and we took God out of our schools. These kids have no hope. They go into the world with no hope. You know, one of the things that kept me from becoming a drug addict as a young person, because I knew I was accountable to God. Mm-hmm. And I knew I had hope in God. There's two things our society has torn down, and there's your demand side. Mm-hmm. So from my perspective, parents, you need to start making your kids, if they want money, they do chores. If they got to understand, I've got my three oldest grandchildren right now. Two are still in school, one's in college. You know what? They're all working. They all work because they know and they'll grow up that way. And it's because you have to raise them that way. And there's your demand side. If we're filling all these jobs with white and black Americans and black and white Americans and Latin Americans and Chinese, you know, whatever they were, I call them Americans. I don't like the period. With Americans, there's no need for that foreign labor.
Well, you know, before immigration became a big topic, I mean, it's always been a topic, but before it came such a big topic, in the early 2000s, because Ohio is not exactly on the southern border. Matter of fact, we're definitely closer to the northern border. What was interesting to me, in Marion, Ohio, and people will know what I'm talking about, there was a business, a big business in town, that was hiring Latin Americans by the truckload. And this is the early 2000s, late 90s. And it was happening at such a great rate that they were getting houses in Marion, and they were shopping at the store, and their kids were going to the schools, that they had to get an interpreter at one school because so many of them were going to school. Now,
we have them at all of our schools right now, by the way.
Well, the interesting thing about that is, if that is happening, and you really care about immigration, if I knew that it was happening, if I knew that they were being hired at that rate illegally at this one particular business, then I'm sure the government knew it. And yeah, nobody ever went in and put a stop to it. Nobody ever went in and said, you're doing something illegal. Nobody ever went in and fined that company. Matter of fact, that company's still in business quite well today.
But you know why they didn't, Scott? Look what happened when they did. You know, the political damage was unbelievable. You know, the media came all over and showed these poor people being taken off in buses and how cruel could they be to do this. And, you know, whoever was involved in doing it was raked through the coals. That's part of the problem, is we have let the political atmosphere control the right and wrong in our laws in this country.
Well, I think it's always going to be a devastating scene to see people being drug away. But I get what I'm saying is the owners were not punished.
They should have been.
That's the problem. Mm-hmm. That's what I'm saying.
And they still should be because it's going on just...
I don't understand. Yes, it is a horrible scene to see people loaded up on buses. It just is. And does the media cover it? Yes, they do. But why was that business never fined? Why were they never, you know, if they had been fined when they first started doing it, that scene at the end wouldn't have happened.
Right.
And supply side.
Exactly. And the humanitarian side of it, I will say this, that, you know, I care for those people. It breaks my heart to see what some of them are going through. But I want people to understand something. The only way we became the country that we did is we stood up and we said, enough is enough. And that's when we were first being founded. And every one of these countries has the ability, in mass and numbers, to say enough's enough. They just got to get to the place to do it. The resources in South America are unbelievable. It could be one of the most wealthy places in the world, but it has been taken over by thugs, by drug lords, by, you know, I read something the other day, the rate of politicians being killed in Mexico. I wouldn't run for office. They kill mayors out there like eating popcorn. And you know, but I'm just saying, if the people would say enough is enough, and as a whole would I'm just saying that we need to fix some things here. And I'm with you, Scott. The problem on the border wouldn't be where it is if we addressed our lifestyle and who we are and what we do here.
And maybe we'll discuss that next Friday.
That'll be great. Let's keep it up.
Stay tuned. Talk of the Town with Marge Hazlett coming up in 10 minutes.
And Marion and Cleveland, everything. Stop getting me laughing.